Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson, and it is day 12 of our membership drive at KHOI. We're asking our listeners to join, and we're looking for 50 new members by the end of the drive, and $25,000 to meet a matching grant laid down by our best and most faithful donors. They will give $25,000 if and only if we can raise that same amount by January 1st. And I understand that today we are very close to the halfway point of $12,500 of that $25,000 that will get us there. So that's good news. Today's show is all about energy. It's about solar energy developments in Ames, including decisions made at last week's City Council meeting, and, of course, about the use of Central Iowa as a transport route for oil from the Bakken region of North Dakota and, ultimately, the tar sands oil from Canada. And, in fact, we have breaking news from Cannonball, North Dakota, where water cannons were unleashed on peaceful protesters at 20 degrees Fahrenheit temperatures, causing them physical harm. And we also have breaking news from Des Moines, Iowa, where some of the water protectors are conducting a hunger strike in front of the Iowa Utilities Board office. More on that later. In the studio are two women who have been thinking about issues related to solar net metering lately. First is Bronwyn Beatty Hansen, Ames City Council member. Welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Thanks for being here. And we also have Betty Baird, a member of the Ames Progressive Alliance, which has been lobbying and working toward an expansion of solar energy in Ames. Welcome, Betty.
Thank you very much.
And so, Betty, you've been working on solar power with the Ames Progressive Alliance. Can you explain what net metering is and how it promotes the development of alternative energy sources?
Thank you. I anticipated that might be the first question, so I came prepared for this one. Net metering, in its traditional sense, is a retail rate, and that's what we have in Ames. We adopted that in 2010, and it's at a retail rate. So right now, residential electricity is about 11.66 cents. So when you buy your electricity for yours at home, that's what you're paying. With net metering, when you generate excess, it goes back to the city. The city credits you with 11.66 per kilowatt. Just so it's the retail rate. The question is, do we want to keep that same type of system at that same rate? And when a solar developer comes in and they talk with you, they see what is the rate structure that's in place and how would that apply. And so if you're thinking about making an investment, you can say, okay, at some point, I think I'm going to gain back what I put into it. If it's at the retail rate, that's going to come earlier. If it's at less than the retail rate, it will come, but it will come later. And so it's the question of when that payback comes to
right.
you. For an individual, that's what they're thinking about. Yeah.
Right. And so Ames adopted this in 2010, you say,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
we now have a retail rate of net metering.
Right. Right.
Of 11 cents.
11.66. And that's the rate that's set. The city of Ames adopted what they call unbundled electric rates. And it's based on a cost of service study that I believe is updated every 5 years. And so they have described rates for residential and for industrial and in between that for general power and large power. So that's the rate structure that they're looking at and looking at modifying.
Okay. And so that's what was on the table on Tuesday, Bronwyn.
Yes, exactly. Yep. We were looking at our net metering policy and specifically the cost or the amount that we're giving back to customers who are generating excess.
Was somebody promoting a particular policy?
Well, UROAB had made a recommendation to council, and their recommendation was that we move to a fixed cost system where instead of that 11.6 cents, we'd be looking more at, well, it depends again, as Betty said, on the type of user. So residential user, for example, instead of 11.66 cents, would be paid 4.5 cents for a kilowatt hour.
That's a significant reduction.
Yeah, I think 61% or so. Yes. It's interesting because when you buy energy on the open market at cost, currently, with the energy market, that's like 2 cents or slightly over. So it's interesting, you know, we definitely as a city have a commitment to green energy. I would think most people would expect, you know, that we are encouraging solar somehow. But when you're looking at buying energy for 2 cents and then paying someone 11 cents who's producing it in their own home, I think UREB wanted to find a closer balance than that.
Right. Well, why is it at 11 cents then right now? Why is the retail cost of electricity at 11 cents if energy is so cheap to buy?
Well, it's not always so cheap to buy. And there are a lot of fixed costs, too, that the utility has to make up for. So, you know, they're constantly replacing equipment. We just converted to natural gas at the power plant. All of that is built into the rate structure, too. So, you know, part of the electric rate that you're paying is going to pay down that conversion of the power plant. Part of it's going to common maintenance and paying utility workers and things like that, too. So that's all built into that retail rate.
Uh-huh. Is the natural gas that we're now using, is that cheaper than the coal was?
I think, yeah, that is true. Yep. Right now, the natural gas market is very low. So that that's interesting to think about, too, because the energy market right now is very low. And it hasn't always been that way, and it won't always be that way. So as the energy market then fluctuates, you know, if the price of natural gas does increase, then the value of solar, you know, solar becomes even more valuable, I think, to have as part of our energy portfolio.
That's right. And with the fixed cost model that Bronwyn was talking about that I mentioned, it for each of those four different users, it says what percentage of that total cost that they're paying, 11.66, is actually the energy cost. And it varies by user, which is interesting. And the rest of it is other kinds of costs that are fixed costs that you need to make that whole system work. For the residential, it's 39% is actually the energy cost. So the proposal based that reimbursement on whatever that energy is. And they said, we'll pay you for that energy cost. Yeah. And as the cost of energy goes up, that means solar, as they change this cost of service study, that will also go up.
Okay. So it's not fixed, per se.
It's fixed for a period of 5 years,
yes,
until they redo their service.
I see. Okay.
And then it'll be tied to the MISO. It's a long phrase, but the MISO average on peak price, basically, will become the measure that they use.
And one of the things, the Ames Progressive Alliance was really encouraging what exactly the council talked about, was that solar is important and we want it to be an incentive. October 18th, Tim Garten phrased that so well, I thought, at the end. He said one of the things we need to tie into this conversation is what value do we place on solar? And he didn't say what it was, but he said that's a concept. At the last meeting, the council talked a lot about that and what they actually came up, and Bronwyn can talk about, is this fixed cost but with some additional incentive tied into that, so the solar owner, the residential installer, would receive more money back. So they said, yes, the solar incentive is important. That was one of the things we wanted to see. The other thing we have learned through the last 2 months of conversation is that there's so much is happening. The solar field is changing constantly. We just heard about Tesla rooftop solar panels that have storage in them. That it's going to keep changing. And so we are adopting a level of certainty right now, but the whole solar market will be changing over the future. The city and UREB, as determined by the council, will be reaching out to all the users, people that are interested, to look at those changes as they go forward.
Okay.
Yeah, we did talk about the rate change, but we also wanted to make sure we're checking back on this because, as Betty said, the technology is improving by leaps and bounds, and there are, you know, estimates. Tesla also has the Powerwall out, which is like a battery, a residential battery, basically, that a solar array can charge. And when storage technology catches up, that'll really be exciting because the disadvantage of solar technology right now is that you get your peak of solar output – in the middle of the day when the sun is the hottest. But the peak of usage during that same time period during the year is actually into the evening when people are home and they have their televisions on and their computers on and their lights on and things like that. And so when storage becomes really viable, I think the value of solar to an electric utility will really improve a lot. And that's exciting. So I think I've even heard estimates that those power walls will be available within a year's time, which, again, makes this the change is just happening very fast.
So you want to make a change in the rate that reflects a little bit more about of the costs of just providing energy that Ames has. But you also want to leave some flexibility in there for developments as they occur.
Yes, exactly. Yep, it's a very dynamic market. So,
So what was decided on Tuesday?
Yep, and we did decide to go with this fixed cost model, but we added an incentive, like Betty mentioned, for, and it varies by user group, but for residential users, we did add an additional 2.5 cents per kilowatt variation there. General power was 2 cents. Industrial users, an extra 1 cent per kilowatt hour. So we did add that incentive to the recommendation that Eurohub had made.
So not 4 cents, but more like 6.5 or?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. That's right. And then we also did make it official that we want to have that check back done in a year and things like that too. So that was really what was agreed on at the council meeting.
Okay. So Betty, as an advocate for solar energy in Ames, are you satisfied with what happened at the council meeting?
I think that it was an amazing conversation. I think both on the 18th, I just actually watched it again. I look at the meeting archive video sometimes. Amazing conversation. I love to see how the council gets involved in it. And I think it was another one at the last council meeting. They definitely said an incentive is important. They said we need to balance what the utility needs in terms of fixed costs, how it affects other stakeholders, and how there is an incentive. So I think they came to a balance.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that. Sounds like a win-win. Thank you so much, Betty Baird and Bronwyn Beatty-Hansen.
Oh, thank you.
This conversation dovetails perfectly with the one scheduled for the second half of the hour, in which pipeline opponents make their case for shutting down the Bakken pipeline. So you folks in the solar power field might not cross paths that often with quote-unquote water protectors, but your actions are really complementary. If we don't have people fighting for alternative energy, then what's the use of trying to shut down gas pipelines? So the breaking news from Cannonball, North Dakota, the Standing Rock Reservation, is that hundreds of water protectors were blasted with a water cannon last night at temperatures below 20 degrees Fahrenheit. Subject to thermal injury, and pepper spray was also used. People were treated for injuries to their eyes. Now, for those of you who believe that those congregated up there are doing something wrong or illegal, perhaps, here is the audio from a one-minute presentation by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., an environmental lawyer, you may recall, who was up in Cannonball this weekend and posted a video on the Waterkeepers Alliance website. That's a national group that is involved in water protection. Here's Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
This is the front line, and what you see here is you see about 40 or 50 police cars and military vehicles on the side.
Not safe for you to be there.
You see them using sound to try to discourage people from coming up here. And this is, and the pipeline is being constructed here. The pipeline's being constructed illegally, right under those lights. They're breaking federal laws. The people who are trying to stop them are actually demanding compliance with the law. So you have an outlaw company that is violating federal court law. And instead of deploying the state action to stop the lawbreaker, the state is deploying this massive military might to stop people who are peacefully protesting and asking for law and order.
And that was Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He was up in Cannonball, North Dakota. That video is available on the Waterkeeper Alliance website, and you can see him standing on a road. There are police cars kind of stacked up behind him, and he gestures to the field just adjacent where pipeline construction is underway. Meanwhile, here in Des Moines, we have the Mississippi Stand water protectors. These are folks who were down in Keokuk, Iowa, where the pipeline will and has crossed the Mississippi River. They were active in trying to slow down that process, putting their bodies in front of machines and so forth. They are now in Des Moines at the IUB headquarters on East Court Street, where they are demanding that the pipeline be shut down by the Iowa Utilities Board because of the illegal actions of the pipeline construction company. They are asking that the IUB enforce the permit that was given back in March of this year. Many people, as you will hear shortly, believe that the Iowa Utility Board has done nothing to enforce the terms of that permit and that the Dakota Access Pipeline has routinely broken those regulations. And these Mississippi Stand water protectors, as they call themselves, are conducting a hunger strike, an open-ended hunger strike in Des Moines at the Iowa Utilities Board building. And one quote from one of the women who is fasting, Jessica Resnick, she is participating in this fast because, quote, when the pipeline breaks, the whole state of Iowa will be fasting. It's time the Iowa Utilities Board does the right thing and shuts down the Dakota Access Pipeline. Well, I was at the very site where they are standing right now on Thursday when the Iowa Utilities Board had its monthly meeting. There were dozens of Iowans present urging the board to shut down the pipeline based on, in part, the hasty construction of the pipeline that has been underway, sort of move people out of the way, don't concern yourself with the due processes of court cases that are still pending and the regulations that I mentioned before that are in the permit that water protectors say have been violated routinely. I've got a medley of voices from that session at the Iowa Utilities Board, and we'll play it now for you.
When this ordeal began, a lot of people said, it's just another pipeline. However, Iowa has never seen a pipe of this magnitude or carrying a hazardous substance like the toxic crude it would carry before. And the company that was created to construct the pipeline, Dakota Access, is a new company created to do that. Therefore, they have never laid a pipe like this before. That makes this experimental. Considering what we've heard today and what we've heard on many days about the rules that Dakota Access has broken in constructing this pipeline, I would call this now a failed experiment.
It was brought to my attention that though it was promised by Dakota Access and their attorneys that the parent companies would be backstopping this, it's been brought to my attention that Sunco Oil has not done that, and that's in violation of something that you guys directed needed to be done for this permit to go through. So I'm asking you to revoke the permit because of that disalignment and all the other issues you've heard today.
We're seeing them work rushing with their equipment in the dark without floodlights. We're seeing them, and I have some pictures here that I took myself back in September 9th. It was 2 5/8 inch of rain the night before and the day before, and it's showing this worker walking through this pond, basically. They were working. They were continuing working during this mess of water in this field that no farmer would ever work in. Then in September 23rd, we got 3 1/2 inches of rain from the previous day. And again, it's just this even bigger sea of water. In fact, the pipe is floating in it. And what we see is that there's no way that you can keep that topsoil separated. So, you know, this is just an inadequate bunch of regulations when we look at what is really happening. And I like to remind you that this is an experimental. What Kathy Holdenfer said, it's an experimental thing. There's never been a 30-inch pipeline. So here we are. We're at risk. We're going to bear the brunt. It's up to you to protect us, and I ask you to shut it down.
Thank you.
My name is Michael Adato. I'm a high school senior at Waukee, and I'm missing school today to be here because I believe that this board has not followed what I understand to be their duty, and that what your duty is to understand, are these utilities good for the public? And I know I don't really matter because I can't vote yet, and I didn't elect Terry Branstad, and I didn't vote for him, so I didn't give you your job. I know that, I'm sorry. But I am the future, and this pipeline, I have to wonder what it does for my future. It doesn't enhance my future in any way. Instead, I believe that it endangers it, first of all, because if it breaks anywhere, the damage is catastrophic. And secondly, it perpetuates climate change. And I don't care whether you believe it or not, because it's a fact. You accept it or you don't, but it is fact and it is truth. And so I must ask, why haven't you done anything about these violations? Why have you been silent? Why have you been silent? Why don't you break the silence and say, you know what? You can't build a pipeline if this is you're going to do this, 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 and this. Why instead do you say, okay, pay me some money, and then you can keep building. We'll give you the permit. You just have to pay me a little bit of money first. I mean, I know I'm young and idealistic, but my understanding of government is that it is for the people and representative of the people. And I struggle to see how the Dakota Access Pipeline represents me, and your advocacy for it, or at least non-opposition to it, affects me in a positive way. I struggle to see that, and I do hope you take action against it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm here today to object to the weak enforcement of protections for landowners as they witness the daily destruction of their soil, water, and forest. On top of that, the process for complaints is obviously a failure. It's a bureaucratic nightmare, and it's posing as an interested process to protect the public welfare and landowners. The lack of monitoring by inspectors has failed to bring to the light of day the massive number of violations witnessed and reported by landowners and concerned citizens. Complaints consistently die or disappear at the county level. That was made obvious today. Where landowners are told that what they think is a violation may not really qualify. Well, farmers and landowners don't need a weak-kneed lecture from the IUB, Dakota Access, or county inspectors as to what may qualify as violations. Who are the real experts here? Farmers have tilled the soil for generations and intimately know the practices that destroy the organic composition of soil. Landowners are keenly aware of factors that destroy productivity, and Dakota Access has the audacity to continue those practices because they know there is no enforcement to stop them. So Dakota Access says, complaints, violations, destruction of soil, water, and protected habitat, shoddy repair work to busted tiles, bring it on. We will simply throw money at these complaints as the cost of doing business, and we will continue to dig, come hell or high water. Repeated violations should not be treated as a first occurrence every time. At some point, this repeat malpractice is criminal. To begin construction, and they thumb their nose at you, and they continue the assault. This resistance to this injustice continues to grow and get stronger. You will not be able to justify, nor will you be vindicated for your part in this destruction if you don't shut it down.
Two years ago, I asked up in Nevada when they had a meeting where they were going to get the crude oil to put in this pipeline because it had fallen below $70 a barrel. Well, those wells only last 2 years, and they're just about to run out. So by the time they get this finished, there'll only be a trickle of oil there. Now, there are Canadian companies involved that were in the failed Keystone XL pipeline. They have bought into Dakota Access, and they're keeping that a secret The answer is they intend to hook up to the old failed Keystone Project and run up to Edmonton, Canada. Now, are we going to allow them to run Canadian oil through the Iowa pipeline?
Mr. Neary, thank you.
My name is Zachary Ide. I'm the son, the nephew, and grandson of landowners in Mahaska County. I'm here because I've heard all of it through my relatives. I've heard the story, so all I can say is I'm disappointed in you. My aunt and uncle have stood before you multiple times and asked to not have the pipeline put in our property. Multiple times, yet eminent domain was used, and now it's finished. They're putting the topsoil in this week. I'm disappointed in you because you chose to do business with an LLC. That was a poor business decision. Surety bond, $250,000. When that could not be raised, we should have said no to you.
The contract for this pipeline was set on 2014 prices. The price of in 2014 of Bakken oil was at $70 a barrel. It is now less than $40. The contract to carry that oil was also based on those prices. And that is why the contract is now set for January 1st. And now there is a 30-day delay. So they are running at all costs to get this pipeline done. What will happen if they don't meet that contract? They are due to go bankrupt. Energy Partners is due to go bankrupt along with Bakken, the oil suppliers. And as you heard before, it is a ruse to use that pipeline for the XL. And Energy Partners is set up so that they can accommodate that. It is not the first time Energy Partners have left a pipeline in the ground unused. Sandpiper Pipeline in Minnesota is such a pipeline, was stopped by one landowner who refused to give up. And we will never give up. Thank you.
So I would like to point out again that we have our customer service reps that are in the conference room, one and two next door. And if there's nothing else, Mr. Wright?
I don't believe there's anything else.
All right. Do either of the board members have any comments? Seeing nothing further to come before the Iowa Utilities Board, we are adjourned at 3:35.
Welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson. We just heard a medley of voices from Thursday's meeting of the Iowa Utilities Board, a three-person governor-appointed board. You heard the voice of the chair, Jerry Huser, at the end. As you heard, the board offered no response to the citizens who came before them, and she and the others refused my request for an interview. Now on the line with me is Wally Taylor of Cedar Rapids. Wally is the lawyer for the Iowa Sierra Club. Welcome, Wally.
Thank you.
And Wally, you have a lawsuit pending in Iowa District Court or U.S. District Court in Polk County. Is that right?
It's an Iowa District Court. It's an appeal from the Utilities Board's decision granting Dakota Access a permit.
And when will you have your court date?
The oral argument. This is not a new trial or a new hearing. It's an oral argument to the judge based on the record that was made before the Utilities Board. And the oral argument on that is December 15th at 9 o'clock at the Polk County Courthouse in Des Moines.
Okay. And obviously you were also there representing the Iowa Sierra Club during the November and December hearings of last year when the Iowa Utilities Board heard different sides of this issue, so to speak. So I wanted to have you on to help us clarify some of the things that were said by some of the folks opposing the pipeline. There was discussion of a January 1 contract that Dakota Access has. Can you explain what that January 1 contract is? Does it create a meaningful deadline for pipeline construction? Is this something that the protesters or protectors are, you know, working against so that every delay means, you know, a greater possibility of that contract date not being met? What's the deal with January 1st?
Well, Dakota Access back in early, mid 2014 signed contracts with a number of oil companies to ship oil on the proposed pipeline once it was built. At the time those contracts were signed, oil was selling for over $100 a barrel. Now it's less than $50 a barrel. But those are what they call take-or-pay contracts, which means that those shippers agreed to pay, you know, whatever the rate was that was in the contract, whether or not they had any oil to ship on the pipeline or not, or how much they had to ship. So the shippers are kind of stuck now with what may be a very unfavorable financial arrangement for them. And we could not see all of the contract. Dakota Access was allowed by the IUB to black out certain portions of the contract. But Dakota Access has been saying over the last month or so that if they don't complete this pipeline and get it in operation by the end of this year, that those contracts can be voided or renegotiated, whatever the shippers would want to do. So it's entirely possible, it seems to me, that if this pipeline is not in operation by the end of the year, that those shippers may very well want to void those contracts.
Okay. Makes sense to me. And the pipeline company presented, or a spokesperson for them, or perhaps somebody reporting what a spokesperson had said, at the Iowa Utilities Board said something like 99% of the pipe is laid, and the opponents of the pipeline strongly disputed that figure, saying that it was kind of a PR thing to give us the idea that they're almost there and just let us get the rest of the way there.
You know, I don't know for sure because I'm out there looking on my own, and I haven't talked to anybody who really has been that I would trust. It is true that Dakota Access has made statements all the way along through this whole process that may not have been exactly accurate. So I don't know, but I am sure that a very, very, very large percentage of the pipe is laid and the dirt has been backfilled over it. I have heard that they're having difficulty boring under the Des Moines River in Boone County, and that's slowing them down. I also heard that, I think in Wapello or Mahaska County, they were behind schedule. So I don't know for sure. The main thing that's been stopping them, of course, is what's been in the national news, and that's the situation with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe up in North Dakota, that the Corps of Engineers has not given Dakota Access a permit to drill under Lake Oahe, which is a reservoir created by a dam on the Missouri River. So that's holding them up as well.
And there was something mentioned also about part of the permit that they received in March from the Iowa Utilities Board, Dakota Access, required a certain insurance policy. The number $250,000 was mentioned, and then there's also some talk about larger backers, larger financial backers that are maybe not signing on where they said they would, or Dakota Access promised they would, or that was the condition of the permit. Sunoco is the parent company that has been referred to in that. Can you explain some of that to us?
Sure. The $250,000 comes from the Iowa code, which for a pipeline, the Iowa law requires a bond of at least $250,000. Of course, that's a drop in the bucket for any damage that would be caused by this pipeline. This was a massive hazardous liquid pipeline. The Utilities Board required Dakota Access to file an insurance policy for $25 million, which they did, and also to have what they call guarantees from the parent companies that those parent companies would pay for any damages caused by the pipeline. The parent companies at that time of the board's decision were Energy Transfer Partners, Phillips 66, and Sunoco. They all had an interest in the pipeline. Only Energy Transfer Partners and Phillips 66 filed guarantees. Sunoco did not. And so there's an argument to be made that the board was requiring all of the parent companies to file guarantees, and that didn't happen. And so, therefore, the conditions of the permit were not met, and therefore the permit should be revoked. And I just found out today that in the last few days, Sunoco has agreed to buy or take over Energy Transfer Partners. So that would make Sunoco the parent company and not Energy Transfer Partners, and Sunoco hasn't filed a parental guarantee. So I think there ought to be some way to go back to the Utilities Board and say, look, the parental guarantees are no good anymore, and you ought to revoke the permits.
Okay, and there's been some pressure on banks to divest. I've read that a bank in Norway has divested from Dakota Access. But you didn't mention any Norway banks, DNB. Are there other stakeholders here beyond the ones that you mentioned?
Well, there are a good number of financial institutions, banks and other financial institutions, that have invested or loaned money, actually, to Energy Transfer Partners to build this pipeline. And the grassroots movement that folks are trying to generate is for people to divest their money in those institutions and then have those institutions get their money out of the pipeline project. In fact, I was up in Dubuque a week or so ago for a rally, and folks who had accounts in the United States Bank up there went in and withdrew their money as a protest of a U.S. Bank's investment in the pipeline project. So that's certainly something that is being urged, is that all of these banks and financial institutions take their money out of the pipeline project.
Okay, so there's two streams of money. There's the money for the insurance policy or the backstopping of that insurance policy. And then, of course, there's all the money that needs to go in to build the pipeline. And that comes from a lot of different sources that we can find online through a Google search. All in all, Wally, it sounds like this pipeline is not at all a done deal.
I don't think it is. I don't think it is. There, Dakota Access from day one has tried to make it seem like it was a done deal from the outset, but here we are. It isn't fully built yet. It's not in operation. So I think we've done a pretty good job of making it not a done deal.
Okay. Well, we're going to leave it at that. Wally Taylor, the lawyer for the Iowa Sierra Club, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Once again, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We're talking about the Bakken Pipeline. There are a couple of breaking news stories. Last night, water protectors in Cannonball, North Dakota, were attacked by water cannon at freezing temperatures, soaking their clothes and creating an inhumane situation. They are peacefully protesting, according to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., that they have every right to stand in the way of what is, according to him, an illegal action by the pipeline company as it continues to build the pipeline up there. And in Des Moines, we have water protectors from the Mississippi Water Stand starting a open-ended hunger strike to urge the Iowa Utilities Board to stop this pipeline. As Wally Taylor just told us, there's more than one reason that the pipeline company could be stopped for acting illegally, for not adhering to the permit that requires certain financial backing, as well as its actions in the field in heavy rains and so forth. I think on the line we have Mark Edwards. Mark?
Yes. Hi, Greta.
Hi. I understand you're up to some action today as well.
Yeah. It's a lot more is happening. I think that's the biggest thing I've got out of listening to the program today, is that more and more people understand what's going on and how things have happened and how fast this process has been shoved through, which is one of the fastest ever. I think we're learning that we need time to look into this a little deeper. These shell games with the money and the insurance and all that is really bringing a lot of things to light that just don't look right. They smell bad. So, but I'm calling to pledge today at $250 in support of KHOI.
Mark, you're pledging at $250. Wow.
Yeah, well, I'm doing it, you've just done great coverage on this, and you're the only media that has been going into this to depth and continuous coverage, and that's why I say is the more people understand what's going on here, the more the outrage is growing, and this Dakota Access Bakken Pipeline thing has just been atrocious, and as mentioned in the comments, it's the first one ever in Iowa. They say we had thousands of miles of pipeline. We've never had a pipeline like this, ever. We're talking about pumping 1 million gallons in 1 hour. So if they have a leak and that comes out, that's going to affect a lot of people. So I'm giving this pledge in the name of the Bakken Pipeline Resistance Coalition. And they can get more information can be found on that Facebook page, No Bakken, Facebook, or NoBakken.com. And we stand with Standing Rock, which has been mentioned, and water is life, and it's been very interesting to watch what's going on up in North Dakota, all the retaliation for nonviolence protest against what's going on there. So I suggest that everyone look into this and follow KHOI's wonderful coverage.
Well, thank you. And we will have some links on the website when we post the story. But there's actually a lot of action right there where you live in Boone County, Mark, and last week you contacted us. We weren't able to get you on the air, but you contacted us about a water protector who had gotten inside a pipe. And when I spoke with him on Thursday, he said he had shut down the operation for, I don't know, 12 or 17 hours. I can't remember what he said, but that's a significant amount of time.
Three, two men and one woman. Actually, there was three people in that pipe. And they've had a couple other actions of actually shutting down the work there also. And, you know, what's been exciting here is that, you know, as we look at Standing Rock and they're fighting over their water, well, we're fighting over our water here, too. And, you know, I live in Boone County. If they have a spill in this watershed, Boone will have to pack it up. We have no other access to water and no way to get the oil out of the water. So it's a big, important thing to us. And so we've had a long history here of different actions. I think I count six or seven right off the top of my head, where we've had great protests, sometimes 150 people. It's been really uplifting to me to see the community support of landowners, all these different political affiliations from both ends of the spectrum coming together over this issue of the pipeline. You don't see that very often, especially at this time in our history.
That's true. And but you've also had trouble there in Boone. You described, I didn't have time to air your comments to the Iowa Utilities Board. You were representing Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement and spoke about the difficulty you had because you weren't a landowner, but you were rather a protector of public lands and public waters, trying to report a situation in Boone County that was detrimental to the environment, the safety of people there, a situation that had been caused by the pipeline construction, and there was just no way to get through to the proper authorities, it sounded like. Could you recap that situation for our listeners?
Well, yeah, after 30 years in the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and dealing with the bureaucracy from the federal level all the way down through my job responsibilities as Army Corps of Engineers and things like that, I have a pretty good tolerance for working through this labyrinth of maze trying to get someone to answer a question. And I have been just blown away by how bad this process is now. Whether they're a landowner and all that, they've set something up where they say they're going to take landowner comments and everything. And I saw abuse of private lands and started out by calling in saying that, you know, this was happening. And I was told by the inspectors that it was none of my business because I didn't own the land. And I began to explain, well, yeah, but they're doing the same thing to the road ditch, which is public, has some public responsibilities. And that didn't get me anywhere either. And so I, when I testified to the IUB board, I tried to give one example of the labyrinth of following through of trying to find someone that would take any responsibility for the public road ditch. And they were pumping thousands of gallons of water into the road ditch, plugging the tile, flooding private property that was, they had no easement on. And then when they kind of got called on that, then they started pumping it into the state highway ditches of Highway 30. I mean, and I was trying to say, I went to the Board of Supervisors. I went to every inspector. I filed a complaint with the IUB. I've done everything that I know possible, and I've gotten no response from anyone taking accountability for these abuses of public land. And I know there's not much oversight either on what's going on these other public areas either. For example, they're tunneling under the Des Moines River, but on the other open creeks and smaller rivers, they're just trenching right through those. And there's, I don't know of any oversight particularly there, because it's public land, and the agreement that they have with the company ISG, which is also hired by Dakota Access. So now the county turns around and hollers the same company to oversee the work being done in the county, but they're only responsible for either private landowner inspection abuse or the Board of Supervisors is responsible for the drainage district. So there's just a number of tiles, okay, that they're responsible for. And the rest of it seems to be just slipping through the cracks. I can get any answers, and that's the most frustrating part, is as you call each office and each person and try to get somebody to respond, I just can't get a response to what's going on or who's holding who responsible. And so I've complained considerably, as many landowners and many other people have, to my board of supervisors, and we tried to pass a resolution stopping it. And then the state has come back and told us through the county attorney that we weren't allowed to do that as a county, that we had no local control to do this.
Right.
And so, you know, we don't know where to go. We can't turn to the IUB board. They're three politically appointed people. You know, they have leanings. So we don't know what to do, and that's been the frustration.
Well, and I could feel that frustration just from the point of view of somebody who's looking for a narrative or a dialogue. I went to that Iowa Utilities Board meeting on Thursday. I heard this just chorus of complaints about illegal activities, violations of the permit that the Iowa Utilities Board had itself authored. And then there was nothing. There was nothing on the other side. They didn't make a single statement in response to this chorus of voices. And, you know, I'm used to going to local, like a county supervisor board meeting where, you know, the supervisors might have had an opinion going into the situation and that opinion didn't change, but at least they had a few words acknowledging the concerns of people who came forward and spoke. But there was nothing of the sort there at the Iowa Utilities Board.
Absolutely, and really hasn't been since the beginning. I mean, that's been the frustration. From the very first public meeting we had, I think it was 4-1, opposing the pipeline, asking questions, and no one being able to answer any questions. And it's proceeded from that, and that began 3 years ago. So you'd think in 3 years we could find some kind of answer besides something put out by Dakota Access in a forum. and then backed up by IUP. It's been atrocious, and I think that's the hardest part with the frustration, is that if we don't have faith in our government, if we can't turn to someone to be accountable, we're a private corporation to come in and do all this thing for private gain and use eminent domain to take away private property and threaten our water. You know, what if we don't have faith in our government, what do we do? You know, I don't know what to do. I'm beyond belief in where we've come through this process.
Well, Mark, you've been our shepherd through this information, through this labyrinth, and I really want to thank you for being that link, being our link to what's going on out there, because it is really important, and we're doing everything we can as a media outlet to, you know, do our job to make the facts known to the public about where we stand and how certain processes just seem to have fallen apart. And
the people that are struggling with all this, you know, your radio station has been the only source. We've been so frustrated with many of the media papers and the coverage, and it's just regurgitating the same old stuff all over. And then the attention all turns to Standing Rock, which we stand with, but we had the same issues here, and we've had no coverage, particularly hardly, of what's going on here. We had, you know, 100-something arrests. We barely can make the paper, and it shouldn't have to come down to arrest to make the paper. You know, there's hundreds of people showing up in the middle of the week on bad weather days to voice their opposition, and to not have to even get media there is just an atrocious to me. I mean, not only should we not get any answers from the public officials, but we don't get any response from the media to cover what we're trying to ask. So thank you. KHI has been a very good for the spirit radio station for us.
Thank you for the $250 donation. That's good for our spirit too. And we're going to have to say goodbye now, but we'll see you again real soon, I'm sure, with more coverage of the Bakken pipeline struggle in Iowa.
Thank you, Greta. Thank you.
And that's it for Local Talk today. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started out the show with a conversation with Bronwyn Beatty Hansen and Betty Baird about solar power in Ames and the new net metering policy, cutting back a little bit on what residents and commercial entities can get for their solar power. But people seem happy anyway. And then, of course, it was the Bakken Pipeline with Wally Taylor, the lawyer for the Iowa Sierra Club. We heard from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. describing the situation in Cannonball, North Dakota, where the people who are breaking the law is the company, he says, as a lawyer, and those who are standing up are asking for law and order, although the police seem to be on the side of the lawbreakers. Today's show will be rebroadcast tomorrow morning, Wednesday morning at 7 a.m. So if you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends. That's when they can catch it. We'll also post it on our website. Local Talk was engineered by Evan Taylor. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. And once again, if you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. And, hey, you can always call in and pledge your support or go to khoyfm.org, press the Donate Now button. We can't do this without a little bit of grease on the wheels. So thanks for listening. We'll see you again real soon on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.